Thank you, Peter. So yes, when I saw the schedule, I was actually horrified. I'll tell you, I was horrified to realize, first of all, that I actually had to talk for 50 minutes, because I thought, I don't have 50 minutes worth of things to say. And then I was horrified because I thought, I'm going to have to be the last person to talk in the day, and everyone will be tired. And as soon as I put up these really strange-looking equations, that'll do them in. And I thought, well, Peter is actually pretty canny here, because he realizes that, and he doesn't want to spoil the whole symposium by doing them in early in the morning. But fortunately, also scheduled it just after the break, so hopefully that's freshened you up a little bit, so that when you see my strange equations, the strange ways of doing things, you've got some possibility of absorbing some of it anyway, or at least trying to figure out what it is I'm getting at. Anyway, let me get on with the talk here. So what I'm going to be talking about is coexistence of species, fundamentally. And so we're going to be talking about that in the context of where those species are preyed upon by predators. It's interesting, adaptive movements, as I noticed before I got here, seems to be, from the point of view of this conference, adaptive movements interacting species, primarily about predator-prey interactions. But we will be seeing some competition taking place here, but the predators are going to have important roles. Now, before I get going, I want to point out that actually, this really all started back in, I think it was 1984, in a paper in the American Naturalist by none other than Bob Holt over there, who really set the stage for this question of the effects of predators on coexistence of prey in a spatial context, and involving adaptive movements there. So Bob actually did really cover a lot of ground in that paper, and I'm not going to cover more ground. I'm actually just going to do it differently, in a way that I hope gives you a different perspective on this question, and different ways of thinking about it. So let me also apologize for the fact that I'm not going to show you any numerics. We're just going to have analytical results, and those really need to be fleshed out with numerical results. But since Jessica and I were traveling too much over the last month, we didn't communicate enough to actually succeed in doing that. So we're just going to have analytical results. So let me tell you about what I'm actually going to do. So first of all, I'm going to tell you about the stuff that's strange, the strange theory that I've developed that I call scale transition theory. And what it's really about is it's going from, we're interested in space, in organisms distributed in space, maybe they're in patches, maybe they're at particular locations. Now, we could be interested in that because we're interested in spatial patterns, but oftentimes we're not interested in spatial patterns. We're actually interested in what's happening to this whole collection of populations on the landscape due to the fact that they're distributed unevenly in space. So that's what I'm going to be doing now, asking the question about what's happening to this population spread across this landscape due to the fact that it's unevenly distributed in space, and also due to the fact that we've got interacting populations here. So this thing called scale transition theory goes from saying, okay, what's happening with local interactions between organisms in space when we want to scale up to the landscape? How do we do that? How do we draw conclusions from it? So scale transition theory is about that process, and it involves always at least two scales. So then we're going to be using that scale transition theory to talk about predation-competition interactions in space. Now, we're always going to be thinking about the prey species as the species that are competing with each other. Of course, the predators are competing with each other here too, but when I say competition here, I'm really focusing on the competition between those prey species. And then they are preyed upon. And so we're going to be using the scale transition theory to draw conclusions about that. So, and in particular, using that scale transition theory, we'll see how coexistence mechanisms arise from the dynamics of those spatial interactions locally in space when we scale them up. And of course we are going to be talking about adaptive movements here, and it's going to be effective adaptive movements of the predator on coexistence of the prey species. Now, my prey species that I'm going to be choosing here are ones that have limited ability to adapt because they're plant species and they're dispersing seeds. Now, obviously, they have some adaptive ability, but the ones that can do it that have really got a behavior that can respond rapidly on a behavioral timescale rather than an evolutionary timescale are seed predators of those prey species. Okay, so let's get going with scale transition theory. So basically, to tell you a bit about it, it can be we can be talking about discrete or continuous time, or we can be talking about discrete or continuous space here. Today, the illustrations are going to be discrete time, and space actually is discrete, although really is not particularly specified. And the fundamentals of scale transition theory, if we're looking at it in discrete time, is to specify a fitness for the organisms of a particular species. So the first subscript is species I. Lambda is its fitness in the usual interpretation, as we'll see down here. X is a spatial location, and T is always time. So lambda is fitness in the sense that if NIXT is the number of individuals in species I at location X in time T, if we multiply that by lambda for that time and location, that is the output from that location of that species at that time. So it's lambda times that. Then they disperse in space somehow. Now, what you won't see much discussion of here, except towards the end, is actually what the dispersal mechanism is. That actually can be pretty much swept under the carpet, provided you've got a statistical description of the outcome of the dispersal. So if we're doing that in continuous time, we're really dealing with the log of this thing, and we call that R. But basically here we're going to be dealing with lambda the whole time. Okay, so here's an example of a lambda for an annual plant population. So we've got species J at location X in time T, and fundamentally then, we're going to think of that population at the beginning of the year as just consisting of the seeds in the soil seed bank. And so what an individual seed can do is it can germinate with probability GJXT, potentially depending on the location. If it germinates and grows into a plant, then it'll have a yield of new seeds, YJXT, except for the fact that that yield will be reduced by competition and predation. So CXT is the rate at which it's reduced, the seed yield is actually reduced by competition in that location, and AXT is the rate at which, in fact, those seeds produced are consumed by seed predators. So we get a form like this. For example, if the Nicholson-Bailey form, which has been discussed quite a lot here in this symposium, just makes that AXT equal to a parameter. Potentially, I've got a J on it here. I'm not going to have a J on it for the rest of the talk, but it could have a J on it, making it species-specific, times the predator density. So we're going to have just one predator species for this talk, PXT, and it's a seed predator, so it consumes the seeds once they're produced. So it's something like a desert rodent or an ant or something like that. Okay, now, what competition could be? It could be the Ricker form of competition, the multi-species Ricker form of competition, in which case the intensity of competition in the negative exponential form is proportional to the total density of seeds that have germinated, so total density of growing plants. Or we could be using, instead of that Ricker form, we could be using the standard contest competition form for plants, in which that is the log of 1 plus a linear function of the density. Okay, so in fact the one we're going to use for this talk is this one here, because that's the one that is most suitable for plant populations, in spite of what Jessica and I have published. Well, you know, we published the one thing, but you don't always. You publish what's easy to do at the time, not what you decide you want to do later. Anyway, so, or what you find you can do later on. So anyway, the important thing about this in scale transition theory is that there is dispersal, so that the output of the population, local population at species J at location X at time T plus 1 is not the output from that location because there's dispersal. So it won't be equal to that output. However, if we sum over the landscape, then the landscape total of the next time is the sum of the outputs in each spatial location. And then from that we can derive some landscape level dynamics. Landscape level dynamics are just the average of the local densities, so just the average of NJXT over X. This should have a J on it, by the way, and this probably should have a J on it too, but landscape level dynamics, N bar, just the average in space of the local densities. And that then, there's a lambda tilde, which is the landscape level fitness times the landscape level population of previous time. So that's the basic formulation of scale transition theory, and you can follow it through like this. And the only thing that's of significance here is really just defining lambda tilde as this ratio, the sum on the landscape at time t plus 1 to the sum on the landscape at time t. This is exactly what you would define it as. That then, of course, is this output from the patches divided by that. And you can manipulate that until it comes down to this form, that's an average over space of the local fitness times the local density divided by the average density, which is then, in fact, the average in space of the local fitness times nu xt, which is, now this is important because I'm going to use this nu xt, which is actually, call it local relative density, is the density at location x compared with the average density in space. And so, in fact, the landscape level fitness is exactly equal to the average in space of the local fitness multiplied by or weighted by the relative density. So that's fairly important because of the next partitioning we do. We can take that landscape level fitness and that then splits up into, well, according to what actually is a form of Pythagoras' theorem, amazingly enough, but anyway, it probably doesn't quite look like that, but basically the average in space of the fitness times the average relative density. Average relative density is actually 1 because it's just the average of this quantity here. It has to average to 1 in space, plus the covariance in space between the fitness and the relative density there. So covariance in space between fitness and the relative density tells us how much we find the organisms concentrated in places where they're more fit. So if in fact they tend to be concentrated in the more fit locations, then this will be positive. If in fact higher density, for instance, what you would get if you just had homogeneous space environmentally but varying density, say a logistic type model, then you would necessarily get a negative covariance here. But if you've got environmental factors leading to greater fitness due to environmental effects, you can get build-up in relation to those without creating a negative fitness. You can get positive covariance between fitness and the density of the organism. So this splits up into this then this average fitness, spatial average fitness, plus the covariance between the two. So we call this thing fitness density covariance and the spatial average of fitness. So here we're starting to get, this is what you would use maybe if you thought there were no spatial effects. This then is a measure of spatial effects, how much fitness is associated with the local abundances. Okay, so why does spatial structure matter to regional dynamics? This is the question here. So we're talking about that. We've got, here's our region. Here we've got locations in space there. We have structure in space. There are differences in densities. There are differences in fitnesses and different spaces in places in space. Why does it matter? Well, I'm going to give you my sort of reasons for why that matters. And so basically, well, first of all, you've got this, you've got the relative density that's giving us the spatial structure, and then fitness varying. There might be some underlying fitness factors, which could be the amount of competition, the amount of parent competition, and some environmental parameter there. Those are all local fitness factors, and lambda itself then is a function of that vector of fitnesses. So that's the actual spatial structure that I'm talking about, a bit different from the spatial structure that some others have talked about. So why it matters? Well, first of all, we find that the actual regional fitness, lambda tilde, which does define how dynamics work in space, because it's the, it governs this equation. This equation is true. So lambda tilde is the actual fitness measure governing regional dynamics. And what we find then, first of all, by the little bit of mathematics we did before, is that that differs from the average, the spatial average fitness, by this association between local fitness and local relative density, measured by this covariance. So that's the first reason why it matters. And the second reason, so if that's not zero, it matters. Second reason is that if we look at this average, average fitness in space, we can't simply substitute in the average fitness factors in there if f is a nonlinear function. So if the translation of competition, apparent competition, and environmental effects translates nonlinearly into the actual local fitness, then this average fitness here, this is going to deviate from the function of the average of those fitness factors. So that's another way in which we see variation in space affecting this landscape level fitness. So there's two ways in which it does it. Now, the thing that of the most importance to us from the point of view of this talk is that these ways that this deviates due to spatial structure generates species coexistence mechanisms, spatial coexistence mechanisms. And the reason why we're talking about it in this adaptive dynamics context is it gives us a handle on analyzing adaptive movements, the role of adaptive movements in species coexistence measures, mechanisms. All right. Okay, so to be specific about it, our fitness function here, the W, the fitness factors, are actually going to be an environmental response, so the response of the organisms to the physical environment in that place in space that'll usually be, in fact, let's be specific about it. What I'm going to have EJX be here is the log of the germination fraction. We could use it, it could be something else, it could be Y, it could be a variety of things, but I'm going to use it as log of germination fraction, simply because we know a lot about how germination does vary with the physical environment in space and in time in annual plant communities. So it's a good quantity for that. And then we're going to have the sum of competition and apparent competition, which I'm just going to call a multi-species density-dependent response. So the species there are responding to the densities of all the other species, all the other annual plant species in particular, is what that really means by density dependence. So I'm not meaning density dependence in terms of the logistic, it's more like density dependence in the whole Locke of Volterra equation for multiple species, treating all of those densities as part of the density-dependent idea. I think it's worthwhile our recognizing that we should generalize single species density dependence to multi-species density dependence because it is a natural generalization. Instead of just going to inter-specific competition or inter-specific apparent competition, there's a natural generalization that we want. So anyway, our lambda then is actually going to be this function g of the log of the germination fraction plus the total density dependence due to competition and apparent competition. So it takes this form. I didn't explain this part of it before, did I? I explained this part. This is what plants germinate. They produce a yield, but that yield is reduced by these density-dependent factors. If they don't germinate, then they stay in the seed bank, but some of them will die. So Sj is the survival rate of the dormant seeds in the seed bank. Okay. Now, I see. That's all right. I lost my script characters. Should have used my own computer. that, oh well, doesn't matter that they're not descriptive. There are two sorts of D's here, aren't there? See them? It might be a bit confusing, but anyway, there's definitely two different sorts of D's. They're supposed to look more different than that than they do. But anyway, fundamentally we've got this equation for lambda, this equation for lambda, and we can massage it by doing a nonlinear transformation, this nonlinear transformation, here where in fact we write, we choose a particular values to do a quadratic approximation about, so a value dj star and ej star, and we define new variables, these ejs, which are how ej affects lambda, lambda minus one actually, at a fixed value of density dependence, and how what the density dependence looks like in terms of one minus lambda at a fixed value of the physical environment. So these are nonlinear transformations of the original fitness factors. And when we do that, we can actually get this nice quadratic approximation to lambda minus one. So lambda being greater than one means that you've got more output from the patch than you put in. So lambda minus one being greater than zero means there's more output from that local patch than you put in. And that is then linearly expressed in terms of the environmental factor, density dependent factor, and the interaction between the two of them. So this is quite a general expansion for models of this sort. It's not specific to the formula that we had here. So quite generally they take this form. And then we can do the averaging in space. We can work out what lambda tilde is. Lambda tilde, if you recall, that's the landscape level fitness. So we've got an expansion for lambda tilde minus one, which turns out to be the average of the environmental factors in space minus the average density dependence plus an interaction coefficient. What is that interaction coefficient? It's really what that interaction coefficient is, and I haven't got a formula up there for it. There's maybe one on the slide there. Gamma is actually just E2 lambda by the ETD. So it's just the cross partial derivative for these D's. And then what we've got here is a spatial covariance. A spatial covariance. So that's the spatial factor coming in. Here we've got spatial averages, so it's not clear that there's any spatial structure involved, but here we've got a covariance in space. So that's measuring spatial structure. And here we've got another covariance in space. They're both measuring some spatial structure. So the spatial structure they're measuring is relatively important, and so let's just think about it. What we're looking at is, so a covariance, we've got an environmental effect plotted here, and it's going to vary in space, and we've got density dependence, which may or may not be associated with it, varying in space too. So if we just plot the results for all of those spatial locations, then lots of spatial locations, then we'll get some sort of scatter plot, and we can work out the statistical covariance from that scatter plot. But anyway, this is a positive spatial association. But we might have had, for instance, just a random spatial location in which a spatial association, in which case, so with the orange ones, it's just random or uncorrelated. So for orange, this would be zero, and for the purples, it's positive. So we might have a positive spatial association, or we might have a zero spatial association, and that shows up in the equation for lambda tilde. So it measures directly that spatial association between these two times this interaction term. And we've got a similar one here. This is actually this here is an approximation to lambda itself. So we can have another one which really is plotting lambda against what's this? This is that local relative density. So we plot nu j down here, then in fact this is lambda, which is well enough approximated from this point of view to xj minus, to ej minus dj. In other words, just the first bit. For an adequate approximation for that covariance, you only need that first bit. So, and that's quite general, except it's only an approximation. And then it gives us a bunch of coexistence mechanisms. In fact, we end up getting four of them coming out of this. So what we're looking for is things that make lambda tilde, in other words, the landscape level fitness, greater than 1 for an invader, greater than 1 at low density when its competitors are sitting at their stationary state that they achieve in the absence of that species. So we're looking for lambda 1 being greater than 0, lambda tilde being greater than 1 rather, and that can be split up into contributions from non-spatial mechanisms, which I've called lambda tilde prime, and three things here which actually depend on structure in space. Now the first of these actually doesn't show up in the model we've got here, but the other two do, something I call the spatial storage effect as opposed to the temporal storage effect, and something I call fitness density covariance. They both end up being coexistence mechanisms. And here's how they come out in that model of annual plants in the seed bank. First of all, this non-spatial mechanism is actually just a comparison of average fitness in space. What it means is that a species, we can look at this, if this quantity is negative, that means species I, on average, is less fit in that environment than its competitors. If it's positive, it means on average that that species is more fit than the average of its competitors. We then get this quantity here, which is the spatial storage effect. And I think these will show up when I do this, yes. Relative nonlinearity turns out to be zero, so I won't have to talk about it. But the spatial storage effect, in fact, is a measurement of this pattern here. So the situation that most commonly arises is that the resident species, so those that are equilibrated in the absence of species I, have positive covariance. Why? Because when the environment's more favorable, it creates more density dependence for them one way or another. So you get positive covariance between the density dependence they're experiencing and the environmental factors. An invader often has a lower covariance because it responds to the environment differently. So in fact, it's at low density, it's not causing density dependence, it's experiencing density dependence because it has a different association with the environment than the higher density residents. It has a lower covariance. So it's the difference in these statistical covariances here which creates a positive value for this quantity. And what that does, a positive value here added on to a fitness difference, what we're looking for is this thing being greater than 1. Now, this quantity here will be negative for some species and positive for others. So it's subtract off from that 1 for some species, those are inferior on average, add on to 1 for those species that are superior on average. When this is positive for species at low density, it helps those inferior species get above the 1 threshold so that they can increase from low density. So this positive value here makes up for this value here, which is negative for some species, positive for 1, helps this whole quantity here get above 1 for all species. When it's above 1 for all species, they all coexist. So we're looking for these quantities down here being positive so that they can negate some of the negative values, well, the negative values that occur up here. So this quantity here has to add to 0, so some of them will be negative, some of them will be positive. These quantities here have to be positive for that to get above 0. They become coexistence mechanisms when they're positive because they help lambda tilde become greater than 1 for all species. So that's the basic idea. Are there any questions about that? I'm going to ask the questions in the middle because this stuff is actually not always easy to get over. Especially...
Oh, you have the covariance terms, you have variance.
No variance terms, they would be there if we had relative nonlinearity, but they're not there because of the structure of the model. So they fall out of these models. But they can be in other models. Yes, Bob.
Yeah, I hope the story that as you originally put it out, had been like it's the simple variability.
Yeah.
If you take the first effect, if you have divided to 0, solve two reasons.
Yeah. You do, because in fact distribution in space substitutes for longevity. So being spread in space. So you can think of it this way. If you think of dormancy as dispersal in time, then when you've got space, you've already got the dispersal in space regardless of dormancy. So for the temporal one, you have to have dispersal in time. Having being distributed across space, connected populations is the life history trait you need. In this case, to create the interaction that's on the previous graph here. Let's have a look at it. So this, where is this interaction term? Here. Yeah, this gamma, which is that thing, that arises directly out of dispersal in space. Given this product form by itself really creates that sort of interaction. So that's the way it goes. Okay, so we get these quantities showing up. They'll be a little bit simpler when we get to specific cases. And good, we've got to the specific cases, which is excellent. I was a little bit worried we were going to run out of time. So I've got a really simple case here. What we're going to have is spatiotemporal variation in just two prey species. So in other words, that's two annual plant species. That's all we've got. So we've just got a fitness comparison here. This is how good species I is on average in that environment compared with how good species R is in that environment. So obviously they're not going to be exactly the same because I don't believe in neutrality, so they can't be exactly the same for any of my models. Some of you might have them exactly the same, but not me. So they're not exactly the same. I've insisted on that from the beginning and from the point of view of taking a model seriously. So they're different. And so what we want to see is this quantity down here being positive to offset the fact that that's going to be negative for one species and positive for another. Now, it's got two factors associated with it. This first term here, these quantities here come from the storage effect. And what they end up being is they come from this covariance relationship, but they're actually somewhat simpler than that. What we've got here is sigma EI, sigma ER. This is actually just the variance of the response of species R to the environment, variance in space. Now, it's actually, you know, the covariance between the ER and itself. That's the notation. The other one is sigma EREI. It's the covariance between EI and ER. So the most common situation is for this covariance to be smaller than this variance. If their variances are the same, then in fact, if their variance is the same, then this is just the correlation between them times their common variance. So if the variances are the same, then this is just sigma squared, rho sigma squared, and this one here is just sigma squared. So that difference then is 1 minus rho times sigma squared. So how much they vary in space in their response to the environment? Oh, okay. I thought you were trying to signal that something was wrong with my pants. I thought, what's wrong with my pants? I went to the bathroom, didn't I fasten them up properly? Well, <yeah. laughs> that's right. So in fact, what's this thing here? You can think of this as, this measures how differently they respond to the physical environment in space. That when multiplied by this quantity here gives us the storage effect due to competition alone. So this is the storage effect due to competition alone when it's multiplied by the average competition divided by the average competition minus 1. So that's the storage effect due to competition. We have another term here, theta r. That is the storage effect due to predation that arises when we have adaptive movements in the predators. So when the predators are actually seeking out places, successfully seeking out places with more prey. So if they're not doing that, if they're just moving randomly over the landscape, we don't get a storage effect due to predation, we only get a storage effect due to competition. And what happens, too, is when we add the predators, if there's no adaptive behavior, then the predators reduce the magnitude of competition. This whole term actually gets smaller, and the storage effect due to competition gets smaller. That means coexistence becomes more difficult. So if we just add the predators on there, without this adaptive behavior, they introduce apparent competition, which replaces some of the competition. And unless the predators got their adaptive behavior, we in fact get less coexistence out of it. So predation without adaptive behavior in this context undermines coexistence by undermining the storage effect due to competition. We also have another quantity here. It's basically the same thing, but it's now due to the variation in space. So this is the variance in space of the resident species measured in relative density, and this is the covariance between the resident and the invader in space. So if they're really doing exactly the same distribution in space, then this is zero. But if they have different distributions in space, then this quantity here is likely to be positive. So this then fits into, you can't exactly see it from there, but fits into fitness density covariance. So fitness density covariance then actually is multiplied by the same constant over here, and it behaves in exactly the same way, to a degree. The complication is that this is simple. This is just a variance of the environment in space. It doesn't depend on the parameters. The densities of the relative density of the species in space depends on a whole complex of factors that we haven't even told you about, like how the seeds disperse. So in fact, in general, we really know nothing about that. But let's just suppose that we do have the difference in distribution in space, then this would be positive, and that's a sort of a reasonable expectation. We've done some numerics, we would give you some examples. In fact, we have some numerics, but Jessica and I haven't communicated about them, so I couldn't talk about them. But so this would be positive. Now, the question becomes, what does the predator do to that distribution in space? At the moment, we don't know. But we do know, without this adaptive behavior here, we would have a piece of this missing, and we have the storage effect due to competition, at least, undermined by predation. We can't be sure in general what happens to fitness density covariance associated with competition at this stage. Okay, now, how do we get theta? Well, we actually need an equation for predator dynamics. And this is actually just the Nicholson-Bailey equation, which we've seen discussed here before. This is just the predator equation for Nicholson-Bailey, and that defines predator fitness in space. If we wanted to assume we get an ideal free distribution, and a lot of people seem to think that that happens a fair bit. I've been paying attention today, although not always. And it's likely to occur here because of the monotonic form of this fitness function. We assume that equals 1 in space. We can actually easily express local predator density as a function of prey densities and prey environment. And theta then is just a derivative of that function evaluated at the log of the average predator resident species density plus this point at which we expanded the environment quadratically. So these are all approximations, of course, as I mentioned. And then that gives us a theta value in these equations here. Okay, now, that's just for spatiotemporal variation with two prey species. We can take this expansion further. But before we do that, it looks like I'm going to summarize it. So let's do that. So what we get here, effects of predation. Predation weakens competition by lowering prey densities, and those are the plants. And so this weakens competition-based coexistence mechanisms and promotes coexistence. Really? No, it doesn't do that. It undermines coexistence. So that's the opposite of what it's meant to say. that's what I get for writing it during the talks this morning. But anyway, trying to listen and write at the same time. With adaptive predator movement, we get predation-based mechanisms appearing. So we get a predation-based spatial storage effect, we get a predation-based fitness density covariance effect entering these terms. And so we get the storage effect due to apparent competition and fitness density covariance due to apparent competition. And what we don't know yet is how much they compensate for the reduction in competition-based mechanisms. Competition-based mechanisms are undermined by lowering the value of this average value of competition, but they may or may not compensate. Now, we've done quite a lot of models of this sort with temporal dynamics, and we know that sometimes with temporal dynamics rather than spatial dynamics, the predation-based mechanisms are able to compensate fully or even overcompensate. Sometimes they don't. So it's actually going to depend on a whole lot of details that we don't have. So this is what I showed you for just a simple case of spatio-temporal variation, but we actually can make it more complicated. We can have both spatio-temporal variation and pure spatial variation, so that's fixed differences in space, as well as differences that are changing over time. So some places may have, on average, permanently better than another place, even though with time they're all moving around in some way. So if we do that, then we get a whole lot more variance terms in here, and we get another term down here, which is just due to the ability of the species to build up in its favorable locations. One species' ability to build up in its favorable locations relative to another, that arises too. Due to the fact that, in fact, on average, a particular location remains good over time. If it remains favorable in a particular spot, there's a possibility of the population to build up in that spot. And so this term comes in the fitness density covariance term. But what we've got in the storage effect term, we get covariances between environment and fitness entering the storage effect too. Some other comparisons, and also fitness density covariance term has those terms in it as well as the fitness terms, due to the fact that some places in space are sticking with that an average environment permanently. And that means that nu r is directly a function of that permanent component of the environment in a particular location. So we get this more complicated form. So what I really want to show you this for is that it allows us to actually dissect out really what is actually happening with these coexistence mechanisms. We can say, okay, here's what competition is doing here due to this competition is contributing this much. This is the competition-based mechanism, this times this. And we can see how predation undermines it by lowering the Cs and possibly changing the nus around. Although that is something that we actually have to study through simulations or numerical work or other approximations to do that. And then we've got what predation adds back in through that adaptive movement. And it's multiplied by the same thing. So, and then we've got the same terms, the same sorts of things for the other mechanism. So what we can actually do is dissect the coexistence mechanism that's applying in a particular situation into components, and then we can study how the different processes operating in that system affect it. And those can be sorted out into spatial distribution things and average effects, which are over here. Average effects on the total magnitude of competition, the total ability of the predators to aggregate in the areas of high prey density, the total tendency to do that, times the spatial effects that come along. So these things, it gives you the ability then to analyze the model in a way that's not possible to do if you're not able to sort it out in terms of these mechanisms. So what it means is that you might look at the final output of the model normally and say, okay, we added predation, it didn't have much effect. In fact, I saw this at ESA. There was one of Jonathan Levine's students had a really nice model of desert annual plants, and one particular way of adding predation had no effect whatsoever on the final outcome. But what it did do, and it wasn't, she wasn't really aware of it at the time, it actually substituted predation for competition in one spot, but in an exactly balanced way. So you could see competition dropping out and all the density dependence was due to predation, but because it had a form similar to this, with theta actually having a, theta being actually the complement of this term here, what actually happened is you saw no net effect. But biologically what was going on was predation was being substituted for competition. So from this sort of approach, you can follow through precisely the details. Now I wish I'd had some numerics so I could show you more of that. Instead I have our analytical approximations and not the numerics which actually would quantify the things that we can't get so easily. What's happening with these covariances with nu, because they depend on having a full dynamical model involving dispersal in space where we follow it through and calculate the covariances from the output of that model. Okay. What you can do is you can work out some of these covariances analytically, at least qualitatively, and I've done that in the competition-only case in the past. But really, what we'd like to see is, and we're planning to do, is do the numerical work on these quantities here so we can fully quantify exactly what's happening with these mechanisms. Okay, thanks a bunch.